Hello, this is Majority Rights Radio. I'm guest worker. Today, Daniel, not me, will be interviewing an American, a man whose experience and history is something I can identify with. He's a fellow child of the 1960s, and although his life is much more diverse than me politically, there's a lot in it that is interesting in particular to the times that I knew. So if he talks about his biography, in a way, you will be talking about things which are very foundational to my own understanding of the world. I won't say anything else about him because I think Daniel will do a better job than that. And I'll just tell you that his name is Stan Hess. Here you go.
Okay. So this is Daniels from Majority Rights, and today I'm going to be talking with Stan Hess along with GW whenever he'd like to chime in. And I first heard, well, it sounded like Zeus. I was in one of those beta states, half in sleep and half out, and I heard somebody somewhere talking. It seemed like a dream, talking in terms of white advocacy that I've never heard before. It was so bold, so confident, so wow, just what I needed to hear. This is the real stuff. And it turned out to be that when I woke up and re-listened to that VOR show the next day, that it was Stan Hess's first show for the Voice of Reason Network. I want to say hi to Stan Hess and welcome to Majority Rights. And we're going to be talking back and forth, sharing some biographical information, how we proceeded to sort things out, and then confront the JQ and where we think things might go from there. Hi, Stan.
Daniel, it's good to be here, and thanks, GW, for making this happen.
The thing that attracted me to talking to Stan first is that, like me, he wants to advocate all European peoples, and that resonates with me. He's not a divisive figure, but he likes all of us as I like all of us, and I care about us in our entirety and our discrete kinds as well. I care about both. And I think that Stan's on the same page in that regard. And he understands the importance of the JQ. That's important as well. We're going to begin with some biographical information. I'll start first, because people, they might not be as familiar with me. My starting point was one of confusion or an indeterminate situation. I didn't have a clear ethnic position. I'm half Italian and half Polish American, so there was some ambiguity there which didn't help to underpin the confusion of my family and of the social scene of the 60s and the rule structures that were being trammeled with. I wouldn't have had I wouldn't have been articulate enough to say as much at the time, but it was the 60s, but I was already troubled by the Vietnam War and what seemed like endless wars at that point. I mean, there was World War, you could see on television things about World War II, and then there was Vietnam. And here, it struck me as a child that males were being sent to Vietnam to die just because they were male. And we had this thing called feminism, and these women were complaining about, it seemed like their complaints were so trivial by comparison. It upset me. It put a little chip on my shoulder. And then I lived not too far from Newark, New Jersey, where the 1967 Newark riots were. So I began to wonder why we had to have anything to do with blacks. I was told that they were on welfare, and I didn't understand why we had to why we would have to pay for them or have anything to do with them. It made no sense to me. I remember the day that Martin Luther King his death was announced on the TV, being really upset because my cartoons were interrupted. And I was also bothered by Malcolm X saying that he was going to rule me. It never sat right with me. And by the age of 10, I was bused to go to a mostly black school. And that really gave me a sense of racial reality, cold water in the face. But during this time, my older siblings were hippies, and my older brother Larry, he went to Woodstock, and I liked the music, and I had a yearning for this era. I didn't exactly know why, but I knew that there was something there. I knew that there was something there to the hippie stuff. I also knew that the moment the Vietnam War was over, it was over. I understand it now, I think, but then what happened was it seemed feminism kicked into high gear at that point, and there was a build up. It started like the anti-white man narrative started building up, and it was very ominous. All the things that have come to pass, it's not at all surprising. Everything was pointing that way. It was ominous, and yeah, I hoped for better. I hoped to escape. I knew I wanted to get to a white situation, but I couldn't find anybody to talk to. It was really strange. When it comes to the Holocaust, the only thing I can say is that when they started running that Holocaust stuff in the 70s.
Very late 70s, Daniel. It wasn't in the early 70s. The first time I became aware of it was Herman Wolf's, who wrote The Winds of War?
And
it went on television with Bob Mitchum in it, and that must have been about 1981.
Yeah, I'm up to that point now. I'm past the early 70s now. I'm into the late 70s now. And it did strike me even then, is like, why is it that only Jews are so significant? Why they're casualties? What's going on here? They're the only important ones. So it's already becoming a bit obvious that they're doing something with the media. But as you said, our problems and these ambiguities and these disconcerting things then shift to a description, something more descriptive of the problem, and that happened with me in the mid 80s as I was thinking of paradoxes, and then I read some existential writer talking about some passages from Heidegger, and Heidegger, this was an important step for me. Heidegger advised placing your biography into a narrative perspective, a historical narrative perspective, and I did that, and I saw that I looked back on this hippie feminist thing, and I saw that there was something there that was important, and I also noticed that it fit into a way of analyzing. It fit well into Maslow's hierarchy for a couple reasons, and
we're talking about needs here.
Hierarchy of needs, yeah. And that for Dan, Betty Friedan, in her feminist mystique, she was talking about Maslow as well, and as it turns out, she was a student of Maslow. So things began to fit together there, and I thought that I would take that to a graduate school career, begin to develop these ideas of that sort there. And I vacillated between a normal life or one of activism until about the late 80s, because until then it was just this narrative buildup. That's when I started seeing things I hadn't really seen before. I hadn't seen white women walking around with blacks yet at that point, not until like the mid to late 80s. And I saw some of these athletes, I was still a sports fan, getting away with murder. And at that point, I swore off sports. I even sold my record collection. I'm dating myself a bit, even though, of course, I liked a lot of black music. And I thought about pursuing a career with an Anglo-Saxon professor up at Northeastern University. And it was there I was confronted more fully with the Jewish question. But before I go into that, I'd like to see where Stan might connect. I had a yearning for the 60s, and which eventually did lead me to Berkeley, California, and San Francisco, and to try to go to that mecca of these things that I yearned for, the being of white male, an intrinsic value for white men as opposed to the Vietnam War. So I went up there, and it was done. It was 1979. I still had my long hair. I was a living anachronism, but I was searching for that. But Stan did make it there in a more timely fashion in 1971 to be there with his best friend Hillary Clinton. Is that right, Stan?
Well, she was. I lived at the Berkeley Inn, which is no longer there. It was on Telegraph and Haste. I was right across the street from People's Park. And Hillary Clinton, in the, according to some stuff I've seen on the internet, in the summer of 71, she was living up on Derby Street, like the 2600 block of Derby, which was, I don't know, four or five blocks from where I used to live, there at the Berkeley Inn. So, but the Berkeley was a real cultural shock to me because of the fact that I was rejected because of my last name and also because I was from Texas. I was a redneck, considered a redneck with a German last name. And I remember on July 4th, I think it was 1971, you probably know where Ho Chi Minh Park used to be. It was actually Willard Park.
I remember.
The radicals referred to it as Ho Chi Minh Park. And I became, I saw feminism Berkeley style on July 4th when they had an all-day gathering of radical people, and a white woman was doing a belly dance, and the feminists started shrieking at her. And I took up for her. It was oddly enough, myself and an African student, black African student, we both denounced the feminists for not allowing this woman to do with her body the way she wanted. And so it was really a fun time to be able to go back and forth with them. And the black guy said to this one feminist, who probably was Jewish, said, you know, no white woman can tell me what to do. And you know, she had said earlier, no man can tell me what to do. Of course, she wasn't going to say a black man. And so there was this strange unity between this black African guy and myself. And we could see what a cluster, you know what, clusterfuck it was with all these shrieking feminists. And one woman asked me, she said, I bet you work too. And I said, yeah, I go to work. Well, then she said, you're a pig. Wow. So, but because I wouldn't back down, one woman liked my spirit and yelled out, visceral man, visceral man. Like she saw that that what I was doing was good on some kind of level. But it was a clusterfuck. And later on, at that night at the school, we watched Marx Brothers films. And I never really understood why the Jewish radicals were laughing at that. But of course, the Marx Brothers films was all about getting over on us, Jewish guys getting over on European people. So anyway, you know, I didn't evolve because I felt like Daniel said, that I was somebody who was an oddball until I started reaching out to other people. And eventually, when I became a bus driver, a union bus driver, I met some guys who were also radicals, who now were looking at the radical movement because of the way feminists were treating us in the radical movement.
Yeah, I think that, Stan, I think it's really important to tease apart the authentic motives of white hippies, which were for real, in contradistinction to the Vietnam War, the intrinsic value of white men and what Heidegger called de sane or mit de sane, being amidst the group, and the radicalism of the 60s, Herbert Marcuse's Free Love, Civil Rights for Blacks, and Black Power, and radical Jewish feminism. And these things are frequent by younger white activists. These things are frequently confused. They say, "Oh, those hippies! They were all," they merge these two issues. And I think it's very egregious. It becomes a way of blaming white men again, not only of blaming white men again, but blaming white men for doing something that was really important and was never articulated properly. Even John Lennon, didn't have a whole. He said, "Oh, the hippies. That was a great way to meet women." That's not what it was about. That's not what was important about it. So I think it's important to draw that distinction between the kind of Berkeley radicals and the San Francisco hippies in terms of motivation. One other thing that resonated with me is that you talked about strange alliances with blacks. I spent a couple months in a homeless shelter once, and there were a lot of blacks there, of course. And one of the blacks was messing around with white women, and I started giving him all this shit, and the black women at the shelter, they loved me for it. I said, "You're gonna be all right. You're gonna be all right." It's like I had like a great affinity with black women because of giving shit to one of the brothers who was messing with white women. Anyway, so I remember the story you told about being told by women in the Bay Area that you and your friends scared them. I had this too. Women would tell me that it scared them, and that here they would be on their knees for Black Panthers and whatnot, who were as frightening as anybody could possibly be, and it was totally ridiculous.
I remember the book. I just had to bring it up so I got the right title. Tom Wolfe's book, Radical Chic and the Mau Mauing, the Flak Catchers. And that book came out in 1970. And the copy of the book that I had a picture of a white woman, very, very gutsy looking, with a black glove on her left hand, her left clenched fist. With her arm around a black guy or right next to a Black Panther type of guy. And that was the imagery back then. And a lot of women, in order for them to establish their credentials, had to sleep with a black guy.
Oh, man, it really pissed me off.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, there was a book that was written, and I guess it was the 70s. It was called Sexual Racism. And in there... there was a woman who was talking about the fact of how black men were supposed to go with white women, but black women and white men were left out, and the fact that feminist organizers would have parties where they would educate the white women, and then they would tell them that, again, that in order for them to be able to be radical, they had to sleep with a black man.
See, this is another of the things that the Jews totally reversed in terms of logic. The last thing that should happen is white women should be going with black men. This would be something that basically doesn't happen. It's unthinkable. And how anybody could accept it. It was bizarre, totally bizarre to me.
It's, well, what was
and
happening?
Then it goes to that thing about logic, about how I think that a lot of white guys are trying to show how logical they are and establish their moral superiority, one or the other. They're not necessarily the same, but how they can be dishonest and saying that they don't care about these things in order to show that they're above people and their extra logical capacity, and or in the case of maybe the English upper class, how they might show that they're morally superior by not being racists and so forth.
Well, where a lot of white men went after the feminism, white feminists started, chewing them out, chewing all of us out. There were white men that were in the radical movement.
Tell me about it.
Is that a lot of white men started dating Asian women in San Francisco because they were subservient, okay, supposedly. And so that was going on. The other thing, which a lot of men probably wouldn't admit to, but I'll admit to it, I couldn't get a date with a white woman, whether she was a businesswoman in San Francisco or Berkeley, or whether it was a radical woman, because those are the kinds that were around. So what I did, I would when I was a cab driver or when I was a bus driver, I would just hit on women who had too much to drink. Usually women who had too much to drink who were older than me. Because see, what was going on at that time, they were older white women who were dissatisfied with what was going on, because the younger white women were having all the fun. So those of us who were smart, we said, well, we'll just have relationships with older white women. So that's what I did.
Sounds good.
It sounds very racy, honestly. I have had the most boring sexual career listening to you two guys.
I was no great success with women now and then. But.
Well, see, the other thing that was going on at that time was massage parlors. And a lot of guys, and I was one of them, that was your sexual relationship also, was to go into massage parlors, because you weren't going to get laid otherwise. So you might as well just go in and pay for it, because you're going to pay for it anyway. In fact, when I went over to England in 2000, one of the things I did was I made sure, because I knew I wasn't going to have any kind of relationships when I went over there, so I just went to a London massage parlor. So,
and you got a massage. Now, when did you? No, you had, I think, three different incidents with black crime. You were used as a human shield going into a bank in Texas.
No, this was in Houston in about 1970.
In Texas,
I helped organize the labor union there, the Teamster Union, a place where I worked, which was Harris County News Company. Houston is in Harris County in Texas. And I had helped organize that. And I was very active and a very much, you know, pro-black and all that. And then I had volunteered to deliver magazines, because that's what I was in. I was a magazine delivery guy, delivering magazines in the black community. So on one of those occasions, I had a black guy put a shotgun to my back while I was delivering magazines to a Safeway store, and I was used as a shield to go into the store, and the black guy with his buddy had us all lay down on the cold concrete floor, and I thought we were going to be shot. And then the shotgun went off by mistake, and it was so close to me, I thought I'd been shot. But that was the first incident. And then when I went to the Bay Area, I was a cab driver for Yellow Cab in Oakland, and a black teenager shot me in the face and called me a white boy. And then 6 weeks after that, I had another black guy who I picked up off the street, who put a gun to my head and locked me in the trunk of my cab. And two other yellow cab drivers had the same thing happen to them. So after all that happened, my politics changed.
Makes sense. I was kind of anti-black pretty early on. When I heard Malcolm X say that the black man was going to rule, that didn't take well. And when I got bused to go to a black school and I saw the riots in Newark, I knew some okay black people, but I also knew that I didn't want to have to live with them, let alone share resources.
It was dangerous.
It was dangerous, but it's just unpleasant. It's like being in a it's like being in a monkey cage if you go to a black school. It really is. It's horrible.
Well, that's
mate competition, isn't it?
It's
mate competition.
What?
It's mate competition, isn't it? I mean, dominance behavior all the time.
It comes to that, yeah.
Yeah, and you only got to see these guys walking down the street. You know, you'll see them, and one of them will always be the man. And it's apparent that this is the most important aspect of male-to-male behavior amongst blacks, certainly young blacks anyway. It's very important for them to establish hierarchies, and often these are established on violence. Certainly in prisons, it's exactly the way it works. Not that I spend a lot of time in prison, but there we
go. Well, that's what kept me out of jail. My father said, you know, don't get a jail. They'll hold a knife to your throat and expect you to submit.
There's a criminologist, I don't know if he's still alive, his name is Gary LaFrie, and when I was reading Instauration magazine in the 70s and 80s, he had produced this study of interracial rape, and it talked about how a huge majority of interracial rape was black on white. So I started following that in William Wilbanks' book, The Myth of a Racist Criminal Justice System. But
Oh,
Stan.
He fell off again?
Yeah, he's gone again.
GW, I was going to ask you, let's try to get him back, but I was going to ask you, you were at the other, another sort of hippie epicenter during the 60s in London.
Yeah, my own experience. Well, I was a very conventional person. I was not a hippie. In fact, I was the angriest of the angry young men. I was so bloody angry. I was angry with the hippies. I rejected their sense of rebellion. It seemed to me to be conformism. I was so bloody.
Well, it even made less sense in England. You didn't have the draft there. So.
Well, you know,
it was even more hedonistic.
When I was very young, I decided that really I didn't.
You weren't angry. You weren't angrier than me, but go on.
Oh no! I'm sure I wasn't angrier than you, Daniel. I'd never attempt. But I was very angry and rebellious, and I had been all the way through school. It never occurred to me that school was anything other than a penal colony, which I was locked into until a certain age. And because I was quite bright, I kept getting left in it.
I got out of school, I was so happy because I could read the books that I wanted to read.
That's right. At the age of 18, I was forced to do a university entrance form, but I was absolutely determined that I wasn't going to go to university because what I wanted to do was to drive cars. You know, when I did get out, the first thing I did was to enter upon a long splurge of educating myself as I saw fit. And in fact, that lasted till 8 years. It lasted through my marriage, beginning of my marriage. And at the age of 26, I had a big library of books. At the age of 26, I suddenly stopped reading. And I don't know why, I just stopped. I stopped buying books, I stopped taking an interest in that. And at that point, I began really to consider myself as a kind of laboratory for everything and to try to come to terms with some kind of understanding of life. And so that's the way that my own experience was. I wasn't specifically a hippie. I was a little bit too young to be a hippie proper. I found them very annoying and shallow. And yeah, I mean, you know, the political ones.
That was the problem. That was one of the problems. They were inarticulate.
Yes. Yeah, the ones that were articulate were hard leftists.
That's right. Which was something other than what we're talking about.
No, yeah. I mean, I had a job at one point in the Strand, in an office block, famous office block called Bush House in the Strand, and I remember watching these characters from the LSE, London School of Economics, who would traipse down there so that they could ritualistically do a sit-in, you know. And they would come traipsing down past our windows, and I'd look at them, and honestly, they were such an unappealing bunch. And there was absolutely nothing in their politics or in the approach to life that didn't disgust me. So I was not a hippie. I didn't have very long hair. What I wanted to do was to race cars, and everything I did was devoted to that from quite a young age. I decided I was going to do that at about the age of 16. And devoted everything I could to that. Took lots and lots of different jobs to try to earn money to do it. Eventually began a business. It wasn't a proper business, but a little company with three of my friends who had similar ambitions. And two of us actually made it and two of us didn't to sort of low-grade racing. And I was one of the ones that didn't because I met a little blonde girl who I duly married, and that was the end of that. So... but the intellectual search continued, of course, and at the age of 26, I emerged from that into, I suppose, a sort of condition of a sort of nascent thinking man with quite a lot of information, but of course very, very ponderous in my thinking and without very much sense of direction. So I was a sort of self-created individual, really, and I've suffered from it ever since, I guess.
Well, I think it's worked out quite well, it seems.
Well, I don't know about that, but I sure can't change it now. It's a little bit late. But there we are. I'm still trying to understand the world. You know, I've got a conversation going on at the moment on Western Spring with these people who don't want to understand the world, which, you know, presumably in your inbox you get the emails, do you? So you see the comments they make. We've got Stan back, haven't we?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, great.
I'm back again.
Stan, we were talking about a problem of coordinating simple messages for the masses, for, you know, practical action and a respect for the intellectual theorizing as well that's necessary to sort these matters out on a metapolitical level. And I, for one, am not going to suffer very easily people who throw around the term pseudo-intellectual when you're speaking in relevant terms and trying to employ intellectual concepts. I think it's true that this is sort of a trick that's been played on us to discourage us from sufficient intellectualizing.
I'm involved in the world of 12-step programs, and that's the way I stay close to what white folks are doing. And if I didn't have that, I would be some kind of a recluse. I encourage people that have families that who've been affected by alcoholism or drug addiction, overeating or whatever, to get involved in 12-step programs, because 99% of the people in these programs are white.
I did it myself. I can recommend it too.
Yeah. So we have to have contact with people on a level where we are giving of ourselves to encourage people to be better than what they are, and to stay away from the whole, you know, intellectual fighting over abstract concepts. I think
now you're sort of going in another direction from what I'm recommending. What I'm trying to encourage at Majority Rights is the hermeneutic circles, that we go back from a more intellectual and far-reaching and speculative grasp of matters to practical matters, but we can't be only concerned with practical or.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is that the people that I have met over the years who've been involved in quote unquote white politics are basically people that don't engage themselves in real life. And they don't have anybody that they can relate to other than the white issues. And if somebody does that, then they're not going to be effective.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, politically, certainly, we are alienated, and we have a great difficulty in communicating, whether that's because of our characters, or the way that we think and work, or whether it's because that's imposed upon us through the media and so on. It's a nice question. I would have said it's very much the latter, probably 80 or 90% the latter, proof of which, if you look at in this country, at the success of the United Kingdom Independence Party, you may have heard about, is doing extraordinarily well. You'll see that it is making a big effort at the moment to expand its reach and bringing in people. Well, there are a hell of a lot of nationalists who are involved in that, quietly. And, you know, if they all had some kind of social disease, I'm sure they wouldn't be able to survive for very long in what is becoming a mainstream unit. I think we're okay.
Problem our message is normal.
Well, yeah, our problem is that
we're living, completely.
We're living in an age of inverted morality and of a very ruthless expression of power against our interests and for interests that are entirely hostile to us. We all know the various components of this problem. I don't need to dwell on them, but I think that's what it's really all about. I'm sure that there are many marginal characters in nationalism for the simple reason that, you know, we do operate out in the Badlands, and you're going to get some tough characters involved. But, you know, that said, I also think that we're very intelligent per se. I think that just to be a nationalist of any level means that you've got to have some kind of critique of politics and of the way the world is running. And just to formulate that kind of critique, that's not easy. That's a real lifetime's work. So, you know, every nationalist has been on that road. We all know about that road. And the road to understanding, which both of you have been talking about. And, you know, it seems to me that's as an IQ filter, probably worth the better part of 10 or 12 points. So there you go. I don't see us as being actually socially isolated.
It's becoming less. I find myself being able to talk about these issues with people.
Absolutely.
The internet's really helping, and I think you need to be a little more patient because things are changing.
Which brings us to propaganda, which brings us to Stan's current activities.
Right. Propaganda.
Yeah. Well, I focus on the sports issue just by telling people, unless you have somebody that you know who's out on the field participating in sports, why go? First of all, most of the owners that I see in professional baseball and football over here are kosher owners. So why in the hell should we supporting their economic interests, and why should we be cheering for black guys?
But Stan, there's a bit of a supply side argument to that, which isn't always most effective. It's like it's like saying, oh, we should be responsible for pollution or lack of a supply side argument when the supply side is making all this invincible pollution. You know, so it's true we should boycott, but there also has to be.
I'd rather use. I use the word mancot. Rather than boy, you know, mancot.
I don't think it's known for that. I think it's to do with an Irish an English absentee landlord in Ireland, actually. But don't worry about it.
Yeah, no. The main thing, you got my drift.
Yeah.
Just be men and stop participating. You know, and get involved in your own sporting activities. Take care of your family. You know, be with your friends. Because the more we disconnect from the media, the stronger we become. Because the media is just one big propaganda box. There's
Hollywood,
a film.
Just a commercial, an anti-white commercial.
Yeah, I just call it kosher wood. But the BBC came out with a film in 2002 called The Century of the Self. And that is the most brilliant expose of what happened to our minds. And it's about Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he was the quote-unquote father of public relations. And he saw the power of being able to manipulate people's minds. In fact, he wrote a book called Propaganda, too. Propaganda used to be a good term. When it first came into being. But the key thing is just disconnect from the TV set. Don't go to the movies. Don't support the movie. Go ahead.
I did, and I feel much better for it. I agree.
Yeah.
I haven't watched TV in years, and oh, God, it's horrible. And not being able to talk back to that thing. Jeez.
Yeah, I do all that. When I used to have TV service, I used to scream.
Shut up.
Okay. I just call it Talmud vision, and really what has happened to us is we are being Zionized by watching that stupid Talmud vision. Don't watch it.
Of the many ways in which we are presented unto ourselves as a being in Olam Haba, you know, in the world to come, that we are presented for our own instruction how to be this unaware being, and television is part of the sort of effort to do that.
And you see, people's concentration level is very, very low. You know, they have most people can only sit still and watch something for 3 to 4 minutes because that's the way our minds have been programmed. So as a result, what's going to be the most effective thing for us in the future in our media is sound bites and images.
Yeah,
that's what the other side does.
Well, I'm okay. I mean, you know, my own view on these things is actually they're nice, but they're not world changing. They don't make a world. Which is what we've got to do. We actually have to remake the world, which is quite a big task, but that is the only task that's really worth talking about.
Yeah, I totally disagree with that, because if you look at what people pay attention to, that's what it is they just duplicate what they see on the television. They'll wear the same kind of clothes, they'll come up with the same kind of sound.
You've got to have both. You have to have both, and we're gonna have both at the majority rights.
Can I just ask Stan a question? I mean,
yeah.
You were talking about detaching essentially from Jewish propaganda, which is right. But you also talked about 12-step program, which is a very Christian approach, and Christianity itself is absolutely a preparation for the world to come, you know, the Jewish world to come. No,
you don't understand. Have you ever been to a 12-step meeting?
No, of course not. No.
No, well, then you don't know what you're talking about
is it not religious?
It's about spirituality. It's not about Christianity.
Okay.
So go to an open AA meeting and see what it's all about before you say
There can be Christian applications, but you don't have to imply it that when they always remind you. You can take what you like and leave the rest.
Right.
It's not a Christian program. It's not, so anyway. Okay.
No, okay. Not. Yeah, that's true.
No, I mean, I always find when anybody's talking about God, it can get a bit that way.
It can, you know, let go and let God. It can be interpreted in a Christian way, which, you know, is, I understand.
It's a God of our understanding, and they talk more about higher power than anything else. Higher power can mean anything, and could mean the group, could mean a philosophy, whatever. But the whole idea of 12-step program is a power greater than ourselves, meaning something that transcends yourself, that uplifts you.
I recommend it helps. It's for people in those situations. I wanted to reconnect with something Stan said about detachment. That I remember in the early 90s, an acquaintance asked me if I was going to see Pulp Fiction, the Quentin Tarantino movie, and I told him no. And he said, why? Because I know what it's going to be about. It's going to be about making excuses for white women to screw blacks. And he said, how did you know? It is kind of like that. There was a scene at the end where, I forget what's his name, is with Uma Thurman.
I said, because, Ving Rhames.
Yeah, because it's a Hollywood movie. I mean, it's just, it's either a leitmotif or just right in your face. And it's always about this.
I mean, Ving Rhames has got the barcode on his neck at the back. You know, there's a vision of the back of his head when he's talking to Bruce Willis in his nightclub, and you see the barcode there, which would indicate that he's been processed by the mind control program, CIA.
MK Ultra.
Yeah, see, that's right.
That's what it is. But that's what it is for me. It may as well be. And then you have John Travolta and Bruce Willis, I guess. There's these zombie whites doing the bidding of. Oops, I think we lost Stan again.
Let's have a look. Hello, Stan is back. Is that Stan?
Hello? That's me.
Hey, Stan.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Back. Stan, how do you see the future, and how should we proceed?
I see it's going to get much worse, but that's going to give us a lot of opportunities to be able to talk to people about why this is happening. I think it's going to be very important to stay true to our culture, what our culture really is, and bring back some traditions, but also to kind of weave them into what we already have. Music is really important. I don't know how many days ago it was, I went to see Elton John in Spokane. And Elton John's music is wonderful. The lyrics I have problems with, but the music is just absolutely superb. And again, if we can create new music with taking some of the beats from the past and rhythms from the past, and also integrate them into what people are listening to now, then we can be able to tell our stories, tell our narratives through music.
That's important. That's the way many cultures promulgate their interests and their worldviews, through songs and chants. And what happens is the people don't even have to be instructed what they do, because they're, you know, the instructions are right there in the music and the chants.
It's interesting you mention Elton John. I mean, he, I guess, would qualify as being about as progressive and liberal as you can get. But you can only make that his, and his husband is probably the, you know, even more so.
Ooh, is it?
Afraid so, yeah. But the actual music, the tone, the musicality of the whole thing, you know, chromatic nature of it and all the rest of it, all that sort of thing, that has nothing to do with being a liberal. You can't be a liberal in those terms, unless, for example, you're trying to be one of the monstrous composers who came up with modernism in music in the early 20th century. But, you know, from what you're talking about, that kind of music, that doesn't come from some kind of liberal philosophy or from any particular philosophy. That comes from the soul. It comes from the European soul. And so that is, that has a quality of reality and permanence about it that is very precious.
Yeah, I also want to recommend the singing group Celtic Thunder, which is an excellent group. And if you go on the internet and just type in Celtic Thunder, that is wonderful music for European people. Another one which is really good is an American, maybe he's from Australia originally, but is Steve McDonald, who has a song called Sons of Somerled, which is on YouTube. And again, that is stirring music. I just want to mention one other thing. Yep. In this area next week, the Renaissance Fair is coming through. And the Renaissance Fair goes all over the country. That's another place where you connect up with English history and English culture. So all those kinds of things are good to kind of kickstart stuff and get people thinking about their heritage.
Yes.
Stan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, because it's been really important to me, because you share in this worldview where you, like me, you want to advocate all European peoples. And I appreciate it especially that you're half German, and that so it's important that German folk know that I want to advocate them the same as anybody. I'm for their nationalism too, and I don't want us to fight. I want us to be on the same side. So I really appreciate your talking to us.
Well, it's good for us to have this conversation. Hopefully we can do it again.
Without the dropping out.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Stan.
Okay. Cheers. Thanks, GW.
Bye.
Thanks, Daniel.
You're welcome.